Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Today, my talk is going to be drawn from a book that I wrote called The Gospel of Happiness. And so I'm going to be kind of summarizing some of the chief insights that are in that book. So if you're interested in the topic, you can check that out. A free version of it actually is available through Word on Fire. So if you Google my name and happiness and Word on Fire, it should pop up. And then you can just put in your information. They'll send you a digital copy of the book. So you can check it out there. I want to start off with a personal experience. So this happened about 10 years ago to me. I interviewed and got a fantastic new job at the Catholic University of America. I was hired as the director of the university honors program. And the new job came with an enormous increase in salary. I got about a 40% raise. And I was able to leave my current university where I was pretty unhappy. I felt like I was kind of on the outs ideologically and theologically, having the wrong views, that is Catholic views. And so moving to the Catholic University of America was really a breath of fresh air. So I moved out there with my wife and family, and I absolutely loved it. The university was filled with extremely bright, dedicated, faithful people. The parish I was in was the best parish I'd ever been in. It had fantastic music, unbelievably good preaching, and most of all, I loved the people that I met there. There were all kinds of people that were just like me, people that were raising families and really trying to live out their faith. And it just was fantastic. So it sounds like this is great. You know, what are you talking about? Personal crisis. Well, there was a personal crisis because as much as I liked being in Washington, D.C., my wife hated it. She hated it. And, you know, as the weeks and months went by, I thought there's a real problem here, because I thought, well, you know, at first when you move somewhere new, it's hard to adjust, but then it kind of, she just wasn't adjusting. So I thought this is a real emergency. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start really praying, and I'm going to have my friends pray that she finds friends here, that she loves it here. And then we're going to have a great experience and everything will turn out great. So I start praying novena, this and that, no change at all in my wife. So I thought, this is really bad. I better pretend it like it's Lent. I better really, you know, double up and offer sacrifice and try everything I can. So I did that for a while. No change at all. So I went to my wife after a while. I thought I better help God out. And I said, honey, you know, I've been really praying that you're going to love Washington, D.C., that you'll find friends, that this would be a great experience for you. And she said, well, that's very interesting. She said, have you asked God what God wants? And I thought, well, no, I haven't. And then after that conversation, I left and I thought, I don't want to know what God wants. Because what if God says to me, you have to go back to Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles? I said, I don't want to do that. And so I didn't pray about it. And maybe about 3 weeks went by and I finally thought, well, maybe I should check in with God. I mean, you know, God's all knowing and all loving and wise, and I should probably just consult a little bit with God to see what God wants. And so I finally got up the courage to pray and ask God what God wanted. And when I did, I felt almost immediately a certainty that God wanted me to go back to Los Angeles. But I thought, you know, when you're praying about something, you can easily make a mistake. So I consulted with a lot of very experienced, very wise people and set the whole matter before them and said, here's what happened. Here's my situation. And they basically all more or less confirmed, yeah, it sounds like God wants you to go back to Los Angeles. So that's what I did. And I'd like to tell you that when I got back to Los Angeles, I was chipper and happy and a nice husband and everything was great, but that would be a lie. I was extremely unhappy. I was miserable. It was just terrible. I missed my friends. I missed being in a supportive environment. I did not enjoy being back in the same old disagreements and the same old sense of marginalization that I felt at my university. And I was very unhappy. And so I did what every good scholar does when they're facing a serious problem. I went to Google and I Googled how to be happier. And something popped up here that I'd never heard of before. What popped up in my Google search was something called positive psychology. And I'd never heard of this before. Positive psychology is a relatively recent movement in psychology. It's about 25 years old, started by a guy named Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania. And what he said to his fellow psychologists when he was president of the American Psychological Association is he said to them, look, we have studied for the most of the history of psychology, we've really focused on depression, anxiety, all kinds of psychological problems, and that's very important. But there's another side of the human condition, and we should not neglect that. So we should also study things like optimism, things like resilience, things like strengths, rather than only focusing on the negative, only focusing on depression, anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. So that's exactly what Seligman and his colleagues did. They focused on what's positive. And this is an empirical investigation. So what they did is they looked at all kinds of literature and all kinds of folk wisdom about what makes people happier. And they decided to test in an empirical way all these different interventions, all these different protocols that you could do to boost your happiness. And so that's what they did. And they founded this whole new field of positive psychology. Now, positive psychology, folks, define happiness in different ways. And so I'm going to look at just one definition of happiness that the positive psychology folks give and Martin Seligman himself gives. So here's how he defines happiness. He defines happiness in terms of five key characteristics. So I want to talk about each one of these. The first for Seligman is positive emotion. Part of happiness, he says, is feeling this positive emotion, feeling up, feeling joyful, etc. But that is not the limit of happiness. That's not all happiness is about. A second part of happiness, according to Seligman, is engagement. And what is engagement? Sometimes this is called flow. The idea of engagement is you are so immersed in some activity that you might be doing it for an hour and a half, but it feels to you as if it's just been 15 minutes. And I'm sure you've all had this experience before. Right? Maybe it's playing sports. You're in the middle of a basketball game and man, you're playing. And it's, again, you've been playing for an hour and a half. It feels like 10 minutes went by. It might be having a great conversation with a friend when you're so engaged and just, you know, you're just focused on that. It could be in lots of other activities. But the basic idea of engagement or flow is that time almost appears to stop. You're just so engaged. You're so involved in what you're doing that, you know, a long time can go by as if just a moment. Another part of happiness, according to Seligman, is relationships. This, in a way, is the heart of happiness for Seligman. The most important thing for him for being happy is having good relationships. It could be in marriage, if you're called to that. It could be having friendships. It could be with just people you know. But the idea is to have a positive relationship with people as being really the central thing for happiness. The next one we just were talking about a little bit, meaning. Now, Seligman defines meaning in the following way. He defines meaning as making a contribution to the well-being of others in a way that goes beyond yourself. So you can have meaning without having positive emotion. So think of someone like Winston Churchill. He was famous for his melancholy. He had times where he felt very, very low. And yet, we probably would all agree, he made an enormous positive contribution outside of himself, right? He saved Europe from being overrun by the Nazis. Another example of that would be President Abraham Lincoln, right? He also was subject to depression and feeling very low. So he was low in positive emotion, but he was very high in terms of making a positive contribution, right? Having the freeing the slaves, civil war, etc., preserving our union. Now, meaning doesn't have to be an enormous contribution to saving civilization the way, you know, Churchill did or Lincoln did. It can be an everyday sense of making someone else's life better. So think of every good mother, with a child, right? All good mothers make their kids' lives better. Now, it's not glamorous. It's not on the front page of the New York Times. Oh, you know, mom changed diaper, you know, amazing news. But nevertheless, these everyday normal acts of serving others and helping others are a way for Seligman of having meaning in life. Another aspect of happiness for Seligman is achievement, right? Setting a goal and reaching your goal. And you may have had this experience in your life. I know I have a to-do list every day, right? I've got on my to-do list to write, to do email, to meet with people, prepare for class. I've got all these things I do pretty much every day, every working day. And so when I go through my list and I check everything off, I feel a sense of accomplishment, of achievement, right? And you may have that too. When you set a goal, I want to graduate from high school and you do it. I want to graduate from college and you do it. I want to get into this, you know, internship and you do it. You have a sense of moving forward. Could be achievement in terms of music, right? Maybe you play an instrument. Say, I want to master this, you know, Ode to Joy. You know, this piano piece. And then once I do that, I'm going to feel a real, you feel a real sense of achievement. So you put all this together, and here's what you get. Happiness, according to Martin Seligman, is PERMA. Positive emotion, engagement, relationship, meaning, and achievement. So that's his acronym, PERMA. That's what he thinks happiness is. Now, the question may arise to you, how does this understanding of happiness relate to Christian faith and practice? There are, in the history of philosophy, some people who think that Christianity is opposed to happiness, that to embrace Christianity is to go against what really is going to provide lasting happiness. So two very famous advocates of this view would be Friedrich Nietzsche. He thought that Christianity is going to be something that deadens the human spirit, that gets in the way as an obstacle to really living a full, happy life. And also Sigmund Freud. So Freud said, when a man is freed of religion, he has a better chance to live a normal and wholesome life. So are these critics correct? And again, I'm talking about on an empirical basis. Is it true on an empirical basis that people who practice faith are deficient in terms of happiness? Again, happiness defined in the secular way by Martin Seligman. I should just say for your information, Martin Seligman is not a believing Christian. In fact, he's kind of it's a little bit unclear his religious views, but he seems to be either agnostic or atheist. So we're not setting up a definition of happiness that's sort of already geared to confirming Christian views. So what did the secular psychologists find when they looked at religious practice? Did it deaden happiness or did it do just the opposite? Well, what they found is that people of faith have, on average, much higher rates of positive emotion. They're much more likely to feel optimistic, engaged, enthused about life, much less likely to be depressed, to be anxious. So if you were aiming to boost positive emotion, religious faith and practice is something that does that rather than hinders that. And religious faith and practice obviously encourages altruism. And if you consider, and again, this is a study Seligman did, the difference between fun activities and altruistic activities. So Seligman said to one group of students, I want all of you guys, to go out and have some fun. Go to the movies, go get ice cream, do some fun activity like that. And then the other group, he said to them, I want you to do some altruistic activity. So I want you to go to the old folks' home and pray with elderly people that are feeling lonely, help them feel better. Go to a school and help tutor kids in learning how to read, right? You guys do some altruistic activities. And both the students went out and did their activities. And what they found was this. The first group of students who did the fun activities did feel a boost in positive emotion. But basically, it went up. And then it went away. A little bit like eating ice cream, right? You eat ice cream, it tastes good while you're eating it. And then when you're done eating it, it's gone, right? By contrast, the students who did altruistic activity, right? They went to the old folks' home, talked to people that were lonely, tried to cheer them up. Those people experienced higher and more long-lasting rates of positive emotion. And so you can see in a very natural way how Christian faith and practice can boost positive emotion. If you were to take the teachings of Jesus seriously, that we have a duty and an obligation and a responsibility to try to be merciful and help those who are in need. Again, whether they're young kids needing to learn how to read or elderly people who feel lonely or people that are hungry, whatever it is, doing those activities is going to boost positive emotion. Secondly, the secular psychologists found that gratitude was extremely important in terms of boosting positive emotion, right? The fact is, all of us in our lives have a mix of things that are positive and things that are not so positive. And it's easy, because we have a negativity bias, to focus just on what's going wrong, right? We've got this financial problem, this relationship problem, this academic problem, whatever it is. And those are true. They probably do have some problems. I do, certainly. But what gratitude does is take our focus onto what's going right, what is good in our life, the good friendships that we have, the beautiful weather that we have, the beautiful, exciting book that we're reading, right? Whatever is true and good and positive, gratitude focuses our attention on that. And as people of faith, we have opportunities for gratitude all the time. So you may know the Greek word Eucharist just means Thanksgiving, right? Every Mass, every Eucharist is an opportunity to give thanks to God for all the blessings in our life, starting with the blessing that we exist, right? That we're conscious, that we're able to relate to God. That is in itself a blessing. They did a famous study of suicide in the United States, and they found that the fewest people commit suicide on Thanksgiving Day. Suicide rates go to in the whole year, the lowest of the whole year is on Thanksgiving Day, right? And the reason seems to me pretty obvious, that on Thanksgiving Day, more than any other day, people in the United States are focused on gratitude, right? Rather than focusing on what they don't have, they're focusing on what they do have. St. Ignatius Loyola talked about the examine, this idea that at the end of every day, you should thank God for the good things in your life. So that's positive emotion. Let's take a look at engagement now. Would being a person of faith help your engagement? Well, it seems to me if you're taking your faith seriously, it certainly would, right? Jesus said, I am at work and my father is at work. So God is a God of activity, right? God is not just doing nothing. God is constantly active. God is perfectly active. God is fully engaged. And then God made man, Jesus, was also fully engaged, right? For 30 years, working presumably with Joseph in, you know, carpentry in a private kind of life. And then for 3 years in a very public engagement with life. It says many times in the gospel, Jesus was tired and had to rest. He was really engaged. He was working hard. And we're called to work hard. And we're called to work well. Whatever work you do, as a student, maybe you're painting houses in the summer, whatever it is you're doing, you can do that in such a way that you produce more work of higher quality. And that is a great service to God, whatever kind of work you do. So Christian belief and practice encourages this. Why? Because we're called to serve our neighbor. And all legitimate work is a way of serving your neighbor, right? Now you might say, well, I'm a student, so I'm not really serving anybody. Well, you're preparing to serve people. Because all of you are going to serve people, presumably through your minds. I doubt anyone in this room is going to serve people through digging ditches or like their physical strength is how they serve people. No, you're going to be doctors, you're going to be lawyers, you're going to be professors, you're going to be whatever it is you are, and you'll serve people through your minds. And when you're in college, that is the time to train your mind. You're training your mind to be more and more intelligent, more and more strong. And the stronger your mind gets, the more you're going to be able to serve people. Right. Think about it. If you become a lawyer, if you're really intelligent, you know the law backwards and forwards, you're really going to be able to serve your clients. Right. If you become a medical doctor and you know medicine super well, you're a real expert. You're really going to be able to help all the patients that come to you. If you become a professor and you really focus on your craft, you really learn as much as you can. Wow. You're going to be a fantastic professor. You're going to be really able to help your students. Right. If you get married and have kids, who's going to be a better parent? A really intelligent, diligent parent who really tries to learn as much as they can about how to raise kids, or someone who isn't like that? Well, I'm going to put my money on the person who's really trying their best and using their intelligence to try to be a good parent. So whatever it is you turn out to do, you're going to be using your mind. And right now, when you're studying in college, graduate school, et cetera, that is Olympic training, right? You're getting ready to serve others using your mind. Third part of PERMA is relationships. And relationships are the heart of happiness, according to Seligman. And in order to have good relationships, one of the key things we need is forgiveness. Right? Why? Because in any kind of relationship you have, if it's a long-term relationship, sooner or later, the person you're in a relationship with is going to do something that hurts you. It's inevitable. And it's true whether you're married or whether you're in a religious life. People are going to do things that you don't like, that hurt your feelings, that make you feel bad about yourself, etc. And if you don't have forgiveness, what you say is, that's it. I'm not talking to that person ever again. They're out of my life. Right? You just mark them off. And you can do that. You can go through life and end up undermining and destroying all long-term relationships. So you just don't have any. You have no one that you've been friends with for 30 years, 40 years. You just don't have one. That is going to undermine your happiness. So forgiveness is a key cornerstone of having good long-term relationships. Now, does Christian faith and practice have anything to say about forgiveness? Do you ever hear any teachings of Jesus about forgiveness? Right? Built right into the Our Father, right? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Think of what Jesus said when he was hanging on the cross, right? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So Jesus taught his followers to practice forgiveness, and forgiveness is hard. I'm sure if I talked to you, you would say, look, you don't understand. This person did this to me. I mean, it was unbelievable. It hurt me so bad. I believe you. But even someone who's your enemy, people of faith are called to forgive. And it's very, very hard to do that. So I would encourage you, if you're in that situation, which you may be, to really pray for that person. It's going to be hard because that person has really hurt you. But pray for that person, right? I'll give you an example from my own life. There was someone who was constantly hurting my feelings at my workplace. So I started praying for this person and the person left. So, you know, it can work. It can really remove, you know, they might move away and you don't have to see them anymore. So this is great. You can try it out for yourself and see if that works for you. I actually wasn't praying that they would leave, but they did. So it's great. Mother Teresa said, let no one ever come to you without leaving better and happier. Be the living expression of God's kindness, kindness in your face, kindness in your eyes, kindness in your smile. We, unless you're a hermit, are constantly interacting with people. And we can make their life just a little bit better, right? By being friendly to them, by maybe listening to them, by offering a kind word. We have every day constant opportunities, countless opportunities to make people's lives just a little bit better, to enhance relationship with them. And this is true also in prayer. So this secular psychologist studied this practice called the loving kindness practice. And the basic idea is that you're wishing well to other people. So maybe you start off with yourself. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. Maybe filled with goodness. And then you pray for those around you. So maybe your husband, wife, your mom or dad, your brother, your sister, and you pray for them. And then you pray for those that are not so closely connected to you. Maybe people that you are at your school, people you work with. The basic idea is you pray for all those people. And then you can end the prayer by praying for everybody. And they studied this practice of loving kindness and found that it actually does increase your loving relationships with others. It helps and aids that process. Because when you're praying for people, you are expressing goodwill for them. And I think people can sense that. I think people, when they talk to you, they can sense, you know what? You're coming from a place of goodwill or not. They can sense you're coming from a place of hostility. I can feel, you know, you might say in California, the negative vibes or whatever. You feel the sort of like, wow, this person is not my friend. But you can be open to friendship with everyone, right? Abraham Lincoln once said, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? So you have enemies, maybe. I bet you do. You have people that have not treated you right. Maybe you can destroy them by making them your friend. It's possible. To do this, what we need to do is look for the good news in people. So think of Darth Vader. A lot's going wrong with Darth Vader, right? Not a very good guy in many ways. And yet, there still was good in him. And you might say, you don't understand, the person in my life really is Darth Vader. He's that bad. They can make a movie about him, and he's just the worst guy ever. Fair enough. He may be the worst guy ever, but even the worst guy ever actually still had some good in him. So think of Darth Vader himself. He was good in terms of using a lightsaber, right? Skilled at that. He was good in terms of running the Death Star, right? You ever try to run a big organization? Very challenging, lots of meetings. You know, you got to organize everything. It's hard. It's a pain in the neck, right? He was good at intimidating people, right? So he had some good characteristics. And he was good in that as long as he was alive, he always had the possibility of turning back to the light side. And that's true of the very worst person on planet Earth right now. Until they're dead, there is always hope. I'll give you an example from my own life. My father-in-law came out as gay in about 1973. And he left my wife and my wife's brother, you know, moved off, gay lifestyle, gone from the church for years and years. And my wife was a very good daughter. She kept up contact with him. And she talked to him on the phone. And it was a very tense relationship because her father-in-law was very prickly, let's say. You know, he would just blast you if you had a different view and the wrong opinion. And he just was hard to deal with. But she kept on being a good daughter to him. And for most of the time, they lived on different coasts. So he lived in New York City, and we're obviously in Los Angeles. But this is about 10 years ago. I spent a year at Princeton in New Jersey, so right by New York City. It's about, take a train in, it's not that far. So anyway, we got to see him a lot. And we you know, we'd go visit him and things like that. And the father-in-law's name was Dennis, my father-in-law. And then he was legally married to this guy, Claudio. So they're, you know, living a gay relationship, obviously. And so we spent the year with them, seeing them often, strengthening this relationship. And then at the end of the year, we were moving back to Los Angeles, and then they were moving to out of the country. And Dennis, in the course of this year, got more and more ill. And it became pretty clear that he, you know, was heading towards death. So the final time we saw them, they walked us out to the curb and gave us a few mementos to remember them by and stuff. And Claudio, the partner of my father-in-law, said to me, he said, "Chris, when I met you, I was so scared because I'm exactly the opposite of you, right? I'm gay, I'm an atheist, and I'm a Jew. And I thought you would hate me." And he said, "You've never been anything but kind and loving to me." And so I said goodbye to him, said goodbye to Dennis, and I saw my wife say goodbye to her father, the last time she'll ever see him. They moved to Uruguay. We moved back to Los Angeles. And my wife still kept in contact with him. And very quickly, my father-in-law got worse. Her dad was getting sicker and sicker. And we talked to the nurse who took care of the dad. And the nurse said, "You know, he's going to die in about a week. I've dealt with many people on their sickbed, and he's heading towards death." And so my wife and I were talking, and we said, "Well, maybe we should try to get a priest to come to, you know, maybe he'll let a priest come give him last rites. Oh, he's been away from the church for over 50 years. Well, we can try." So my wife talked to her dad and said, "Dad, would you want to have a priest come give you last rites? I'm not sick. I'm not going to die. I don't need that." I said, "Well, how about a priest that come in just to pray with you? Would that be okay?" "Well, yeah. Oh, I could handle that. Okay." So we arranged for a priest to go visit him in the hospital. And the priest came and prayed with him. The priest heard his first confession in over 50 years. The priest gave him his last Holy Communion. And he died a few days later. And we talked to the nurse and we said, "Well, how was his death?" And she said, "Well, the priest gave him this crucifix. And he wouldn't let go of it. So I had to wash his hands and his body around while he's holding this crucifix. So we should never, ever give up on anyone. Until it's over, it's not over. And seeing the good in someone and loving them despite difficulties is a way of helping them to move in the right direction. Appreciation. Appreciation is part of love. I talked a little bit about this last night. And this is a beautiful picture. I love this picture of Jesus turning water into wine. So you see the water coming out of the cistern there and going in and turning into wine in midstream like that. And I think this is a beautiful image of what God wants in our relationships. He wants them to be rich, like wine. He wants them to be life-giving and joyful, like wine can be. And to have our relationships be like that, we need to really appreciate the good in other people. And that can take an effort, especially if someone in your life is causing you difficulty, causing you problems. So this picture is a picture I saw when I was at the very worst moment of my marriage with my wife. And I went into a chapel one day, and this was the picture in front of the chapel. And I went in there and I said to God, I actually was writing to God. I said, you know, I am so angry with my wife. I do not want to go back to Los Angeles. This is terrible. Please, God, help me see what's good in her. And I think God did help me see what's good in her. And that is a practice that can be very, very beneficial. Once you've got beef with someone and you just feel like, I can't stand this person, my brother, my sister, my mom, my dad, my whoever, try that. Try going through in front of the Blessed Sacrament and asking God to enlighten your mind. Because God made this person and God loves this person. And yes, that doesn't mean the person's perfect yet. They have their problems. But ask God to really enlighten and show you whatever is true, whatever is good, whatever is beautiful, whatever is noble. If there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, ask God to help you see those things in this person that you're having the trouble with. Seligman has meaning as part of PERMA, and meaning is making a difference for others. And one of the great things about the Christian life is that Mother Teresa and others have really highlighted the fact that we can have meaning in our everyday lives by doing whatever it is we do with great love. It doesn't have to be something that's in the newspaper. It doesn't have to be something that people are going to talk about and say, wow, it's amazing. It can be everyday activities, right? Smiling at somebody, doing the dishes for people in your family, etc. Achievement. Christianity helps here too, because there's two different kinds of achievement, comparative and non-comparative. So comparative achievement is when you say, I'm better than you, right? I make more money than you do. I'm more famous than you are. I'm more powerful than you are. And you get your happiness by doing that. On the other hand, there is non-comparative achievement. And that's when you're not really comparing yourself with somebody else, but you're comparing yourself with yourself. You're doing what you can do as best as you can do it. And if you do that, you have a sense of achievement. Even if you're third place, if you're first place, it doesn't matter. You have done the best you can do with the gifts that God gave you. And that avoids the kind of comparison game, the problems that come from, you know, basing your happiness on, oh, am I better or worse than he is? Well, that's not the relevant question. Am I better or worse with reference to what God has done for me, what God has given to me? And that is something that we can find real achievement in. So does positive psychology replace Christianity? Because everything we've talked about so far is something an atheist could do. An atheist can have positive emotion and volunteer and help people, can have engagement, can have meaning, can have relationships, can have achievement. So is all we need, really, is positive psychology, and we can dispense with Christian belief and practice, even though, as a secular psychologist found, Christian belief and practice does enhance PERMA? Well, I don't think so. And I think there's a number of ways in which the very best of positive psychology fails to deliver. The first would be death. Death destroys PERMA, right? We have no more engagement, relationship, meaning, or achievement. But in Christian faith and practice, we have something that destroys death, right? We have the resurrection. Also, sin undermines PERMA. But secular psychology has no answer for sin. Psychology might be able to help you overcome feelings of guilt, but feelings of guilt and being guilty are two different things. And psychology just doesn't have an answer for that at all. But of course, Christianity does. We have the possibility of forgiveness of sins. That is one of the great blessings that we have, especially as Catholics. Because the fact is, everybody does things that they know is wrong. Everybody. Atheist, agnostic, Buddhist, Hindu, everybody. And so it's a little bit like human beings just make garbage, right? You eat a banana, you got a banana peel left over. And you can carry around your garbage for weeks, for months, for years, for decades. But we as Catholics are so fortunate because we do not have to carry around the garbage we create. We can throw it away, let it go. Every confession is a chance to start over. Take out all the garbage, start fresh, start new. Positive psychology also is lacking any conception of divine providence. There is no Heavenly Father that cares for us in positive psychology. So we can have the great consolation of knowing that whatever we go through in life ultimately is either directly willed by God or minimally permitted by God for our own well-being. God, in the Christian view, of course, cares for each one of us as a loving father. Jesus is our brother. And so again, that does not mean that we're not going to go through difficult times. We might be like Thomas More in the jail awaiting execution. Okay. But even in a very dark place like that, we can still have the confidence of God's love and the knowledge that, you know, whatever I'm going through now, this is not going to be the last word. This is not going to destroy everything. It's not going to ruin everything in my life. And because positive psychology is an empirical discipline, it is neutral with respect to God. There are some positive psychologists that believe in God. There are some positive psychologists that don't. There's no real single view on that. But without God, we couldn't ever find perfect happiness, because without God, we wouldn't have perfect truth, goodness, and love, which is what all human beings seek. So as good as positive psychology is, and I think in many ways it is good, it cannot give us everything that we need and that we want. So if everything I've said so far is true, you might say, well, look it, shouldn't we as Christians always be very happy? And yet I'm sure you've met people that are unhappy, unhappy Christians. Right? I bet you have. If everything I said is true, what explains this? Well, I think we can explain this. And I think one thing that accounts for people that are unhappy Christians is unfortunate genetics. The positive psychology folks say that our happiness is determined partially, about half of it, by our genetics. And you may have noticed this just in your own life. Right? There are some kids on the playground that are just upbeat, filled with joy, running around, having a great time. And some kids on the playground that are in the corner, moping, you know, sad, whatever. It's just, we have a disposition. And some people are just born with a very upbeat, happy, joyful kind of disposition. And some people are not. So if you're a person of faith who happens to be born with this kind of dark, gloomy disposition, this kind of genetic orientation to more see the dark side, well, you're going to be less happy than you would if you were born with a different kind of genetic disposition. Secondly, I think some Christians are unhappy because of physical or psychological difficulties. So obviously, your faith or lack of faith doesn't make you immune from physical or psychological difficulties, right? You can be the most devout Catholic in the world or an atheist, but either way, if you get run over by a car, you're going to feel unhappy about that because you got two broken legs and you're in pain and it's terrible. Right? So you're going to having faith or not having faith doesn't make you immune from these physical maladies that are going to dampen your happiness. Likewise with psychological difficulties, it is true that people that practice faith have lower rates of depression. In fact, there was a study that the Los Angeles Times recently talked about of suicide, and it found that there was one group of people that in this huge number, I think it was, they said like 30 or 40,000 people, this one group of people who had zero cases of suicide. And that was women who went to Mass more than once a week. Zero cases. So it is true that religious faith and practice helps to buffer you against psychological difficulties. But it's also true that religious faith and practice does not make you immune from psychological difficulties. And if you have psychological difficulties, depression, anxiety, or whatever, you're going to be less happy than you would be if you didn't have those things. A final reason why Christians are less happy than they could be is sin. Jesus gives us, you might say, a prescription for increasing our happiness. But people sometimes don't take their prescriptions, right? Imagine you go to the doctor and you're like, oh, doctor, I've got this terrible skin problem. I've got this rash or whatever. Like, oh, yeah, so here, take this, you know, ointment, put it on your skin. Oh, thanks, doctor. That's a great idea. Okay. And you go home and put the ointment in the bathroom behind the mirror and you never use it. Well, it's not going to work, right? You need to actually take the medication if it's going to work. And Jesus, in our tradition, is a doctor, a good doctor, a healer. He gives us the bread and food that we need to have health. He gives us what we need. He gives us the sacraments. He gives us his word. He gives us the church community. But if we don't do that, and in fact, if we do the opposite of that through sinning, through doing actions against love of God and love of neighbor, well, we're going to undermine our own happiness. So simply being baptized obviously is not all you need, right? People in the mafia are baptized. That doesn't give them all they need. So it's not enough to be a cultural Catholic and say, oh, well, you know, I'm baptized. I'm all set. I got confirmed. And, you know, well, no, there's a lot more to it than that. And in fact, it's an ongoing thing. Think about food. Food is not, oh, I got some food a couple years ago. I'm all set. Well, no, you need food on an ongoing basis, right? And we need food from God on an ongoing basis. And that's why prayer is so essential. If you do not pray at least 15 minutes a day, today is the day to start. Today. Make time for God. Every single day, at least 15 minutes and probably more after a while, but start with 15 minutes. You can pray any way you want to, right? You might want to say the rosary. Great. You might want to read a gospel story slowly and imagine yourself in the gospel. Great. You may want to sit in silence. Great. It doesn't matter so much the way in which you pray. It's a little bit like exercise. And you say, well, I hate swimming. Okay, don't swim. Run. Well, I hate running. Fine. Don't run. Do jujitsu. Oh, I hate jujitsu. Oh, fine. Okay. Do, you know, walking. Do something. If you don't exercise, it is going to kill you in terms of physical health. If you don't pray, it's going to kill you in terms of spiritual health. Have to. It's boring. That's okay. Do it anyway. Right? So, if we think about sin, Thomas Aquinas thought about three different causes of sin. He said, some people sin because of ignorance. They just don't know. Some people sin, he thought, because of malice. They're deliberately like, I'm going to get you. I'm going to hurt you. I just want to. And they're malicious. But the third cause of sin is weakness of will. And that, I think, is actually the most common source of sin for good people, at least, that are trying to be good. I'm guessing when you go to confession, it's not like you're totally ignorant that what you did was wrong. And I'm guessing if you go to confession, it wasn't like you're malicious, like I just wanted to do a terrible thing. I'm guessing it was weakness of will, like you had good intentions, you wanted to do the right thing, and oh my gosh, I get in the situation and oh shoot, now all of a sudden I'm doing the wrong thing. So I want to conclude the talk today by talking about willpower, how to strengthen willpower, how to remedy to a degree weakness of will. And I want to draw on a number of psychological studies and research that talk about willpower. And I'm drawing in particular on a book called The Willpower Instinct. So if you're interested in this topic, you can check out that book. So she points out in this book, this is Kelly McGonigal's book, that our brain has different parts. You could talk about the self-control aspect of our brain and the impulsive aspect of our brain, right? We've got a part of our brain that is executive function, prefrontal cortex, a part of our brain, kind of the lizard brain, that just like wants pleasure, wants to avoid pain, and isn't really very reflective like that. So we can avoid, if we want more willpower drainers. So I'll talk about four. The first is lack of sleep. If you want to have good willpower, do not stay up till 3 a.m. scrolling through Instagram or whatever. You're going to have bad willpower unless you get a good night's sleep. Now, you can't always control having a good night's sleep. Maybe you have insomnia. Okay, but we can do what we can do, which would be to allot to ourselves time for real sleep and real rest. If you have trouble sleeping, that's very common. Try to get remedies for that. Andrew Huberman has a huge podcast about protocols for enhancing your sleep. Listen to that. Watch that on YouTube, and you can get lots of scientifically based ideas about how to increase your ability to get a good night's sleep. Secondly, eating well. I love double doubles at In-N-Out. Fantastic. Not fantastic for my willpower, though. So yes, you can have a double double once in a while, but in general, try, if you can, to eat really good, healthy food. That is going to increase your willpower. A third thing that drains willpower is alcohol. Alcohol is going to be an enemy for your willpower. I would ask you to consider whether your life would be better with no alcohol. Maybe yes, maybe no. That's obviously a personal decision. I stopped drinking alcohol on September 11th of last year. So it's been over 6 months. I feel great. I feel like it's been an enormously positive move for me. I'm not telling you what to do, though. It's a free choice. It's your free country. You do what you think is best. But I felt for really probably a couple of years that God was asking me to not drink alcohol. And I kept saying, oh, I don't know. I don't want to do that. It's so weird. Whatever. I don't want to do that. Eventually, finally, I let God guide me to what God wanted for me. And I'm not telling you what to do. It's a free country. If you want to drink alcohol, you can. But I might consider it. Maybe try a test. Right? You can try it next Lent if you want. No alcohol all during Lent. Right? Okay? Try it for a little bit longer. But the bottom line is that alcohol is a definite willpower drainer and buster. So if you want to increase your willpower, a fantastic way to do that is not to use alcohol or to use it very moderately. A fourth thing is stress. And stress is something that we all encounter in different ways, right? You're going to have teachers that give you assignments that make you stressed out. Your parents, your friends say or do things that make you stressed out. It's just part of life. Things in the news are going to stress you out. So it's important, if we can, to try to find remedies for stress. Now, a great remedy for stress is exercise, right? It's a great remedy for stress. So get vigorous exercise. Go for a good run, swim. I like to do jiu-jitsu. Whatever it is you like to do, you do what you do that really gets out stress by a vigorous, hard workout. Okay, that's going to help you a lot with your stress. Another thing the positive psychology folks found is that we can do better with willpower challenges if we flee temptation. So let's say we're trying to resist eating chocolate chip cookies. What you do not want to do is stare at the chocolate chip cookies and put them right on your desk and have them 1 foot away from you and be like, oh, there they are. And then you open the lid and you smell them. Oh, it smells great. You do not want to do this if you're trying to avoid chocolate chip cookies. So get them off your desk, get them out of your visual sight, right? Throw them in the garbage. Don't go buy them at the store. If you do all those things, the likelihood of you getting into chocolate chip cookies is going to go way down. So try that. Another thing suggested by positive psychologists is called surfing the urge. If we have an urge to eat the chocolate chip cookies, it is going to feel as if it's irresistible. It's going to feel like, well, you better give in and eat those chocolate chip cookies. They are so good, and you just are going to miss out. You better give in. And so it can feel like an irresistible urge. But in fact, it's a little bit like a wave. You guys been to the beach? You see a wave coming in. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And even if it's a tidal wave and huge, all waves crash. Right? Even tidal waves do. So you can know, yes, I'm feeling the urge. I want the urge. But if you don't give in, it's going to crash and go away. Right? So what do you do when it's tempting thought comes on your mind? Say you have a white bear. It'll represent the chocolate chip cookies, your temptation. And the white bear comes on the stage of your mind. Well, what you should do with bears, if you're camping and a bear comes in your campground, is you don't fight it, first of all. And also you don't feed it. So what do I mean by fight? If a tempting thought comes in my mind about the chocolate chip cookies and I say, I'm not going to think about chocolate chip cookies. I'm not going to think about chocolate chip cookies. Well, of course I am thinking about chocolate chip cookies now because I'm obsessing about them. So it doesn't work to get rid of a thought by just saying, I'm not going to think about X, because if you think about X, you're going to think about X. So you don't fight it, but you also don't feed it, because what happens if you feed a bear at a campground? Well, the next day you got mama bear, cousin bear, you got 10 bears there. And if you feed them again, now you got 20 bears. That doesn't work either. So what do? You don't fight it and you don't feed it. You just ignore it. And it's there. It's going to sniff around. It's going to do its thing, but it's going to go away. And you've had this experience before. You know, the human mind is naturally restless. It's just the way we're built. You go in to pray, God, I'm giving you my time. I'm focusing just on you, God. And what happens? Like within 5 minutes, you're like, for me, within 10 seconds often, oh, I'm thinking about emails I got to send. I got to do this. I got to do that, whatever. Stuff just, your mind can't stay focused on just one thing, right? Think about when you study. You sit down. I got this big test coming up tomorrow. I'm going to study. And what happens often? Before you know it, you're thinking about whatever, something else. So our mind is naturally restless, which is bad news if we're trying to study or pray because it wanders off. But it's good news if we're tempted. Your mind is going to wander off to something else. Now, even with all these tips, I think that the best we can hope for is improvement rather than perfection. As long as we're here on earth, we're never going to have perfect willpower, perfect control of ourselves. But that does not mean we can't move in the right direction. We can get better, right? We can improve, and that's great. That's great. But perfect happiness is something that is always going to elude us. That is to say, we're never going to perfectly love God here on this earth and perfectly love our neighbor here on this earth. And until we perfectly love God and neighbor, we're not going to have perfect happiness. And so this too is good news, because if we have realistic expectations, if we expect life on earth here to be perfect in a utopia, we're going to be constantly disappointed. But we can have a good life. We can have a happy life, although not a perfectly happy life. That is reserved for the life to come. So that brings us to the end of our discussion of the nature of happiness and psychology and the limits and such. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.